Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You can't rely on blind faith to get the pregnancy support you deserve. Ritual's Essential Prenatal Multivitamin is the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Get 25% off when you visit ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Happy New Year, everyone, and welcome back to The Exchange Live. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted today to be able to speak to professional investor and ex-fund manager Jamie Ward. So welcome, Jamie.
Hi, Paul. How you doing? Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year. Well, it's great to have you on the show. We've got lots of big news actually coming up in January. It's going to be a huge month, no doubt. We've got the President Trump's inauguration on the 20th. We also have a stream of US earnings season or results going to kick off in the next week or so. Plus, I'm sure we're going to get a host of year-end profit upgrades or downgrades over the next few weeks as well. However, before we sort of like, you know, dig through what kind of investor you are and what in your outlook for shares, I'd just like to say a big shout out to our sponsor today, Edison Research, who effectively helping us keep the lights on. They do a cracking job covering lots of stocks around the world, particularly say in the UK. It's all freely available, so anybody wants to sort of like go onto their website, please do. I did actually notice for my own interest, you've got Melrose Industry, which has popped up today, which is an aerospace engineer, and they've been known for sort of like unbundling. I don't know whether you use Edison at all, do you, Jamie?
I have used it a little bit in the past, yeah. I tend to just do my own work. I tend to use third parties as kind of an information gatherer, but then I can't use other people for opinion. It just doesn't sit with me.
Yeah, no, absolutely, yeah. But they're ideal for you know estimates. That's for sure. For because obviously they work with the companies. Okay, good. Well, what would be a nice way to start, because obviously the first time you've been on the show here, Jamie. Could you just give us a couple of words on what kind of stocks, what kind of investor you are?
I've been thinking about that a lot recently. I mean, professionally, I used to have to run my mandate was to run what was called a core fund, which is sort of large cap quality. But I've never particularly had a pigeonhole for myself. You know, it's funny, there's a meme you sometimes see on the internet, which is like a bell curve. And on one end, you've got like a caveman. On the opposite end, you've got like a Jedi. And in the middle, you've got a normal person. And the meme is always that the caveman and the Jedi agree and the normal person doesn't. So if it's like health, for example, it says if you want to be healthy, the caveman will just say, eat well and exercise, and then so will the Jedi. But the person in the middle will go, no, you need to balance all your macro and micronutrients and all this kind of stuff. And you know, when I started out getting interested in investments like 25 years ago, my investment philosophy is I want to buy stuff that goes up a lot. I want to make as much money as possible. And then you go through this whole thing of being a professional investor, talking about diversification and, you know, DCS and all this kind of stuff and getting really involved in it. And it's all very valuable. But then you come out the other end and you think, I just want to buy stuff that goes up a lot. So when you say, what kind of investor are you? I like to buy businesses that I think could be worth a lot more in the future. Whether that's a value company, a growth company, an income company, I'm not really that bothered as long as I can foresee a reason why it could be worth a lot more.
Right. Okay. So it's basically a sort of value based, or is it growth based, GARP based? It can be across a whole different sectors. But essentially, what you're saying is you're trying to work out the intrinsic worth of a particular stock, compare it against the price, and if there's upside, then you opt for it. Is that the sort of like
yes
the,
and
the
no? So some of it's about uncertainty because. You know, I'm a sort of recovering value investor in the sense that value makes a lot of sense to me intrinsically. Like you look at the intrinsic value of a company and what it's trading at and you make investment decisions based on that. But from experience studying and reading, and I read a lot of business biographies and listen to the Founders podcast, which is a really good podcast on sort of, you know, business founders. And what you realize is a lot of the truly exceptional returns, there's no way you can value sort of many, many years in the past. So if you look at something like Amazon, which 21 years ago was probably trading on a P of 200, assuming it had an E at all, what did you value it at? I don't know, but I do know it's made 100 times your money in the last 20 years. So the growth side of it, it's more about people and sort of business concepts. I mean, most investing ultimately comes down to people. Like, you were investing in a person running a business or a team running a business.
So how would you actually assess a management team then, Jamie? I mean, that's, I've always found that's tough, really tough, because the sort of the four sort of aspects I look at is company one, industry two, price value being the third. And that's simple stuff, not simple, but it's you can get your head around it.
Yeah.
And management is actually really tough.
Yeah, I mean, it's about trying to identify characteristics that you like to see in people. So one of the businesses that we're going to talk about in a bit is Wise. I'll go into detail on that when we get to it. But I'd been, you know, as I say, I listen to the Founders podcast and I read books based upon it. I've read a lot of the investment books like Intelligent Investor and those sorts of books in the past. But actually, I find the real value comes from reading about people who have built up big businesses. And a lot of the types of investments I'm interested in all go back to this guy called Sol Price, who set up this book called FedMart in San Diego in about 1948. And it was basically a cash and carry. But he had all these principles that he referred to as shared advantage of scale, which we might refer to as, you know, the bigger you get, the more you give back to the customer and you entrench your competitive advantage. But there's loads of entrepreneurs that came after Sol Price who really, really imbibed a lot of what he said. So, you know, Sam Walton at Walmart, if you read Made in America, which is his autobiography, he finished it just before he died. He talks about Sol Price all the time. Jim Sinegal, the guy that did Costco, the guys that did Home Depot, they all talk about Sol Price. And Jeff Bezos, I've already mentioned Amazon once, but Jeff Bezos, he talks about like building this flywheel of competitive advantage, where you gain scale by being competitive with your pricing and your operations, and that allows you to further be more competitive with your price, more competitive with your operations, and as I say, they call it like the flywheel of or whatever it is. So what I really like to do is try and find entrepreneurs and businessmen who are saying similar things to that. Not just that. I mean, that's one type of entrepreneur. And then, you know, I often won't invest in it straight away. It might be around for a few years. And you sort of listen to what they say, pay attention to their actions. Is it consistent with what they say? Is it consistent with how you would like to see the business being ran? And, you know, I might wait 10 years before I'm actually get comfortable enough to get invested in something. But once I'm there, it's usually because I've got comfortable with the management and with the management strategy. You know, the thought I had a couple of days ago when I knew I was coming on this was, do you know what the three best performing stocks in the S&P 500 over the 30 years are? I think this was true.
I could probably guess. I could certainly do the last 12 months. I mean, that's got to be...
Well, one of them is in the last 12 months. NVIDIA, NVIDIA is number one.
NVIDIA's got to be one. I mean, I'm guessing over the last 30 years, probably got things like Vistra, which is basically the power, you know, AI power boys, which are top drawer, I think. And you've probably got, Amazon.
Well, you've got some good ones in it. I mean, Amazon's at a disadvantage because it's not been listed for 30 years. So if you're missing 10 years of performance, you're always going to struggle. I mean, Amazon's done very well. No, because I see what you've done there. You've gone very techie, very post-internet age. The three best performers are NVIDIA, number one, Monster Beverage, branded goods company, and NVR, which is a house builder. It's done something like 250,000% in 30 years, a house builder. And what separates out those three businesses, because they're completely different sectors, is they've got management teams that really, really know how to extract value.
Good. Okay. Well, yeah. One thing I do, you know, notice with management teams is that they can actually change as like they go through. They can start off brilliantly and then they struggle, and they have life, you know, things happen in their life that actually disorientate them. But that's great. And so putting that together, sort of like, how are you viewing sort of 2025 in terms of optimism in sort of stocks and say compared to the US and the UK and small caps, large caps?
I mean, it's a very difficult question to answer. To be an investor, you have to be an optimist. If you're going to be if you're going to be pessimistic all the time, you're probably in the wrong game. I've had this sort of aphorism that I came up with a few years ago, which is: if you want to make money, be an optimist. If you want to sound clever, be a pessimist. So you often go on certain other financial podcasts you go to some of the more popular newsletters and stuff, and it's all doom and gloom, but it's very interesting.
Yeah,
but it doesn't make you any money. And what you need to be doing as an investor is trying to find the individual businesses that, regardless of what happens in the next 10 years, are going to thrive. So for 2025, the UK clearly looks very, very cheap. One of the problems with just simply being cheap is so much seems to be driven by passive flows, and passive flows is driven by liquidity, and it's completely disinterested in valuation.
Mm.
And that's been a theme for quite a long time now. And I think it's what's been entrenching this kind of dichotomy between US and non-US valuations. Because the bigger US gets, the bigger part of the index it becomes, and the more flows it seems to get. And it's difficult. I would like to say the UK is going to massively outperform this year, but I would have said it last year, and the US is absolutely destroyed again.
Mm.
So, you know. I'm a stock investor. I'm not an index investor. That's what probably would conclude by saying, you know, I'm interested in businesses.
Yeah. Well, all I would say is if you're an optimist and you want to make money, then there's deep value in UK. So eventually we should be able to see some intrinsic worth coming through with a bit of luck. Just a reminder to anybody, if you want to ask Jamie any questions, then please put them into the chat bot and I'll read them out. We got one from Steve Waters, actually. He's asking about, I don't know if you ever looked at it. It's basically the orthopedics medtech business, Smith and Nephew, which they're basically knees and hips and stuff like that, perennially very, very cheap. The problem is obviously it's got a bit of debt and it's competing against Stryker, who are probably the industry sort of poster child. How do you see it's a FTSE 100 company, actually?
It has been such a disappointment over the last 10 years or so. I mean, I think it is because of the Stryker thing. If you'd asked someone 10 years ago, a lot of people said, oh, the big bull case on Smith and Nephew, good balance sheet, all that kind of stuff, Stryker will buy it. That's what's going to happen. What I don't think people realize is Stryker were going to outcompete it, which I think is probably what is actually happening. And then on top of that, you've had a series of not great CEOs. I forget the guy's name now.
There's a new chap in there.
Yeah, there is. I mean, they've got through quite a few in quite a short period of time as well. I really liked Ronald Diggleman, but he didn't stick around very long. But the guy that preceded him, Namal... I can't remember his name now, but he tried to get it relisted in the US in order to get a US style compensation package for himself. So it just feels like they keep attracting the wrong management. It's one of those ones where, yes, it looks cheap, but it's looked cheap for 10 years and it could look cheap for another 10 years. And the thing is with investing is it's only 2025 once, and where you place your capital in 2025 is going to determine how much you have in 2035. And I feel like, you know, the old Buffett saying, why would I invest in my 20th best idea? And this might be your 20th best idea when I can invest more in my best idea. And I suspect this is never going to be your best idea or even in your top 10.
I would say, Steve, just on the optimistic, on the glasses half full looking at it, they have actually recently said that they've got organic growth, which is about the first time in 2 or 3 years in the half year statement. And on the downside, they had the debt, which was increasing. So I think their net debt to EBITDA is about 2.5 times. But I would say if they can get that orthopedic business humming with robotic surgeries, knees and hips and stuff, and get on a comparative with Stryker, plus then you get the end of the destocking in medicine, then actually they should do well. But as Jamie rightly says, should and do are two different things. Yeah. But okay. All right, well, let's go to one of your... Yeah, go on.
So just one last thing on Smith and Nephew. They were a victim of COVID, of course, because it sort of... Yes. It was non-essential medical stuff. So there might be a, in the same way that some of the beneficiaries of COVID have done really, really badly post COVID because of the kind of, they've got they sold ahead years worth of products in a couple of years. Yeah. Things like Smith and Nephew, but then again, you think, well, maybe Stryker's the one that actually benefits from it. So,
yeah, Stryker is just much more expensive, I think. Okay, good. Let's go to one you like. We've got Wise, which has actually done pretty well of late. It does international foreign exchange payments, etc. What's the sort of the USPs and the sort of the competitive landscape in e-payments at the moment?
So for Wise, I mean, historically, the way that foreign currency transfer has been done is through the SWIFT system, which is like a cooperative set up by a bunch of banks in Belgium in the early 70s. In the early 70s, it was technology advanced. In 2025, it's the equivalent of a typewriter. And there hasn't really been, I mean, there's been improvements in the technology underlying SWIFT over the years, but there needed to be a fundamental ground up. This needs changing. The problem is within the financial services system itself, there was never really much of a motivation to do so because it was a big expense for little benefit to them. So what it's taken is Wise to come along and say, there's a problem with SWIFT in itself, and maybe we can replace that. So what Wise does is it just has bank accounts in different places. And when you deposit in one, it takes out of another and vice versa, and it completely eliminates SWIFT. It's a lot more complicated than it sounds because it requires all sorts of legal documents in place in various different territories, and that's where the sort of the USP and the advantages come from. I talked earlier, I said that the thing that you're really interested in doing when you're investing is you're investing in people, and it's the people here that I think are really interesting. It's run by a guy called Christo Carmen, who he falls foul of ESG on the G part of it, because he owns about 20% of the stock, but he's got more than 50% of the voting right. In other words, he has total control without having in excess of 50% of the economic vote. But he looks, not a lot, he talks a lot like people like your Sol Price and your Jeff Bezos and people like that, in that he will say things that the markets will find off-putting because he's interested in what this business looks like in 10 years, not this year. So one of the things that people sort of get, some people struggle with is, you know, you go to a bank and you do a currency transfer, it costs you 6% and takes a week. You go to Wise, it costs you 0.6% and it takes you 20 seconds. And everyone's like, well, that's already brilliant. Let's just make money doing that. Whereas he's going, no, we're going to make it free. Not this year, not next year, but eventually it's going to be free. You're going to come to us and we're going to do a currency transfer. It didn't cost you anything. And people are like, well, that doesn't really make any sense. How are you ever going to make any money if that's what you do? And I think they're missing the sort of long-term possibility here, which is they've built this new infrastructure for financial services, like guide rails for any kind of foreign currency transfer. And by using their scale and passing it on to their customers, they're becoming an entrenched competitor whereby virtually no one can compete on price or quality of service anymore. And two things. Firstly, they make money even when they charge nothing, because in order to be transferring money through them, you need to have money on deposit with them, and they will take a portion of that, just like a bank would.
Right. Okay.
And then the other thing is they're offering ancillary services. So, you know, you do debit cards and stuff like that. So even though it's not a bank, if you have money with Wise, you can use it like it is a bank. So if you're a customer, just because it's not called a bank, if it acts like a bank, you don't really care. But the third wheel, the really, really interesting thing is what's called the platform business. And this is why it motored towards the in Q4 this year. And it's why I think it really could start motoring over the next few years. So platform is when financial services white label on Wise's platform, i.e. financial services companies decide they want to stop using SWIFT and use what Wise has built instead.
Yep.
I've written an article. It's actually in the current Money Week, but by tomorrow it'll be last week's Money Week because it comes out on Friday. And I use an analogy in that, which is the best analogy I could come up with, which is, banks are like train companies and SWIFT is like the railway lines. So if you want to go from Manchester to London, a train company will go, that's 250 quid and it'll take you 2 hours. And Wise has come along and said, you want to go from Manchester to London, it'll cost you 25 quid and it will teleport you. You'll be there straight away. You don't have to wait 2 hours. You'll be there. And the banks are like, how the hell are we going to compete with this? Because, you know, we can't knock 90% off our cost, and we certainly can't get you there instantly. So instead of trying to compete, the banks are beginning to join it. And that's what platform is. So it started out in the UK with Monzo. Monzo, a little challenger bank. Not many people are that interested in it. But, you know, you do currency transfer on Monzo, and it's actually through Wise. So Wise are now charging Monzo for them to use their platform rather than using Swift. And that's all well and good and fairly interesting. Q3 last year, Standard Chartered signed up. And now you're talking a big bank.
Yeah.
A big bank that does a lot of international currency. And that's when it when you see that September bump, September, October bump, that I think was people beginning to realize, hang on, Standard Chartered's on now. There might be more to it than this. Just before Christmas, they then announced that Morgan Stanley have signed up to the platform. And I feel like we're at the start of a snowball running down a very large hill with a lot of snow on it. Because if more and more financial services businesses join onto this platform, then it effectively becomes the infrastructure for global currency transfer. And, you know, last year they put 130 billion through their infrastructure in currency transfers. But if you they spend an awful lot on tech. They've got 1,500 developers and all sorts of costs go into that. They're saying now they could do trillions and trillions and it wouldn't be an issue. So they're only doing 130 billion, but they're saying they're going to do they can do trillions. Mm. They've got the capacity to do trillions. They might well be doing trillions in not that long. And if that start and that does happen, people won't, it won't be in any kind of valuation. So returning to that point, how do I think about valuation? Yeah. On a business like Wise, your 2025 earnings figures are they're not irrelevant, but yes. they're missing the big picture, which is your optimistic case could be in 2030 their earnings are up here, not up here.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, when it comes to valuation, they're on about 28 times, but you're right. In case, the E's, you can't really take it. I mean, they are very, given they are an affordable, on the cheap side, sort of like of transfers, they do make very good margins, still a 38% EBIT margin, or EBITDA margin. So they're not exactly, you know, unprofitable, are they? They're still making lots of money.
If you listen to Christo, the CEO, he will tell you they actually make too much money. Because they're not a bank, they can't give back as much to the customers in the UK as if they were a bank. So they're trying to do a workaround so they can give more back to the customers and further entrench that competitive advantage. They want to be closer to a 20% margin. It's amazing, isn't it? This that's what I mean, like shared advantage of scale. And that's what Wise are doing.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Okay, good. We've got a question coming in from Ben Sharma. He's just asking about the life assurers. Any thoughts on sort of M&G? LNG, Legal & General, Aviva, Phoenix, anybody on the life assurance at all? They're all pretty cheap, I believe. Big dividend yields.
Yeah, it's not really my type of investing because it's all about income and sort of surety and as you say, cheapness. I think about opportunity cost, where I'm placing capital for 10, 15, 20 years. And I don't necessarily think these are the best places to be, but at the same time, I think the rate environment's quite attractive for them at the moment.
Yeah, you're probably right, isn't it? If the interest rates coming down, you mean? But I suppose if it stays at 4%, then they make money, don't they, on their investments, don't they? They're sort of, when they pick up premium, then they put it into short term gilts and stuff like that, and they can make 4%, I imagine. I would just say when it comes to sort of the insurers, they're real income stocks. And I think they've got decent balance sheets, as long as you don't get a huge sort of Liz Truss moment, which has happened like 2 years ago when bond gilt yields went all over the place, then they should be all right. But I know they were all in real difficulties because I think they had to be bailed out by the Bank of England, didn't they, when the went sky high.
And they've, as you say, they look cheap, but they've looked cheap for a very long time. And they're currently, £4.68 a share. They first hit £4.68 a share in 1989.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's move to a recovery stock. We've got Burberry, which was the fashion house, etc. Well known for all their trench coats and outerwear and scarves and stuff like this. They've been through, as you. When it comes to management teams, they've been through more sort of like CEOs than Man United have of managers, I think. So what's your sort of your view on this one? I mean, the share price has obviously really struggled.
So I've been watching. I mean, in theory, they're a high quality business. Returns on capital are high, and the returns on capital are high because you've got brand value there, essentially. And the balance sheet is better than it appears because some of it's effectively accountancy rule changing. IFRS 16 put the leases on the balance sheet, and I don't think that's completely fair with a business like Burberry. Anyway, they've clearly had a bit of a rough time of it. I think the main problem is the trend has gone towards more casual, and they're not good on casual. They're more on this kind of smarter end of things. The reason I put Burberry on there is to highlight how my investment process sort of evolved over time. Because, you know, 10 years ago, if I'd seen them come down from, where's that, 26 down to about 13, and I was looking at the valuation metrics at 13, I'd think that's really quite interesting. And I probably would have invested. However, despite having a skeptical stance on it, I've increasingly tried to incorporate technical analysis into when I actually make a purchase. So I was watching Burberry, and it comes about through really just grim experience, like times when you have bought things that you thought are cheap and the chart's gone, you shouldn't be buying this. And then the chart turned out to be right and you were down 30% in the next 6 months. And that's the kind of thing that would have happened if Burberry had I maintained that old mindset. I mean, you lost half your money again, actually more, from 13 quid, and it already looks cheap at 13. Once it started turning and it appeared like the worst might be over, I actually did open a position in it. And I think that was about £7.50 or something. Then just not, I think it was in Q4, there was a rumor that Moncler were going to make a bid for it. And I've long thought that Burberry actually makes far more sense as part of a larger company, where you have like a portfolio approach, like a Kering or an LVMH, probably not LVMH because it's not quite high end enough for them, but a Moncler makes perfect sense to me. So I wonder whether the reason the chart started turning is because someone out there knew that Moncler were probably running the slide all over them. Yeah. I wouldn't discount that as a possibility that they will go in there. As it stands now, Burberry to me looks cheap. If you look at Google Trends analysis for Burberry globally, it seems to have gone past its worst, and actually people are getting more interested in the brand again, which I think is quite important. And whilst it's sort of still going up, or basically appears to be going up, I'm a happy holder. It isn't one of those excuse me, it isn't one of those businesses where, you know, I would see myself holding it in 10, 15, 20 years time. I think it is one of those sorts of things where when it gets really popular, you really need to be coming away from this. And history has certainly shown that to be the case. But for now, I think it's cheap, it's going in the right direction, and there is still that possibility that you might get a bid at some point, which is all, you know, pretty positive stuff.
Mm. The backdrop for luxury goods, though, is pretty tough, isn't it? Particularly in China, which and Asia, which I think is one of their sort of like key selling markets.
It is, yeah. Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's move to another luxury brand. We've got Aston Martin, which are the cars you'd kill for to have one of those. They sort of retail about £250,000. Make obviously the iconic James Bond sports cars, a few USVs, and the sort of specials and new models and all this sort of stuff. How are you seeing sort of Aston Martin going forward? Because I know they've got quite a lot of debt, haven't they, or something?
They have. Okay, so I am. I'm actually very positive on them as a business, but not so much as a share. And I'll explain why. So they came to market, it's pre-COVID. It must have been about 17, 18, somewhere around there. And they came out of private equity. And it's the standard private equity thing. They wrecked the business. They underinvested in it, undercapitalized it, and overdebted it.
Yeah.
And then brought it to market. And then the poor punters who took it on IPO have got absolutely creamed. Yeah. I think you're probably down over 90% at this point. But then it gets interesting when Lawrence Stroll gets involved. So Lawrence Stroll, I think people disregard him as a slightly clownish figure because he's like the dad of an F1 driver who's a billionaire that throws his weight around and is a big personality. The reality is he's a self-made billionaire. He's not a fool. Mm-hmm. You know, he basically had the rights to Tommy Hilfiger outside of North America, and he exploited them to the max. Like they made some serious money. Him and a guy called Silas Chow, based out of Hong Kong. The reason why I think I like the business, but I'm not convinced by the stock though, is he talks to the company and him talk to the city very differently to how they talk to car journalists. So if you listen to what their announcements are, it always just seems like doom and gloom. Mm-hmm. And they're doing some very bizarre things. Like they raised some debt last year, and they raised it at something like 10.5% interest rate. Now, right. It's not the best business in the world, but it shouldn't be paying 10.5% interest rate. But by raising debt at 10.5% interest, it sort of told the market, this is in trouble. And yes. Funny enough, the market didn't like it very much. Mm. But then you look at what they're saying to car journalists, and you know, Lawrence Stroll had a sit-down meal with a very well-respected UK car journalist called Andrew Frankel, who's been around for a long time. And he was saying, you know, we took some very difficult decisions in 2019, 2020, where they invested massively into the business. I mean, hugely. And they injected a load of equity in order so that once you got past about 2024, funny enough, so into 2025, 6, 7, 8 onwards, they're going to be in a position where their cars are going to be better made. They're going to be all on modern platforms. They've got 4 platforms and all of them are more or less brand new. You know, you look at something like Porsche and, you know, the 911 platform is 6 years old at this point. The Panamera platform is 7 years old. These aren't new cars anymore, but everything under Aston Martin is new. And I think some people don't realize that sometimes platforms can last a very long time. You know, famously, the Vanquish platform was something like 25 years old by the time it got retired. It wasn't always called a Vanquish. So anyway, during these sort of chats with car journalists, they're going, you know, we currently make 6,500 cars a year. We could easily make double-digit thousands, you know, 10, 11, 13,000. And we're going to have really good cars and they're going to be competitively priced. And this is an objective opinion, but they also happen to be probably the most beautiful cars in the world. Mm. You compare that to something like Lamborghini, which is a niche company. They already make tens of thousands. You know, Aston Martin selling as many cars as Rolls-Royce, which is properly niche. Porsche sells in the hundreds of thousands. Ferrari sells in the tens of thousands. There's no reason why AML can't sell in the tens of thousands. And it only needs to sell like 11,000. Now, the thing about AML or any car manufacturer is there's a lot of operational gearing. So whilst they are at best break even at 6,500 cars a year, at 10,000 cars a year, they could be making masses. I mean, really bucket loads of money. So positive on the business, because I think there's a possibility that they could sell a hell of a lot more cars in a few years' time than they are now, and that's very profitable. So why aren't I interested in the stock? Conspiracy theory of mine, which is why would you go out and raise debt at silly interest rates and keep telling the market that everything's a bit doom and gloom and keep talking about how capital markets don't get you and all this kind of stuff? Lawrence Stroll owns 30% of this. It's currently got a market cap of, I think, just shy of $1 billion. He's worth $3 billion.
Mm.
If I was Lawrence Stroll, I'd be thinking I could probably buy this whole thing for $1.2 billion, run it for the next 4 years, relist it probably in the US, and by which time, instead of being more just about break even, I'm making $500 million a year in EBIT, and I'm being given a 12 times EBIT valuation, and suddenly I've got a business worth $6 billion. So I think that's actually where Aston Martin could go. It could be that kind of business that is worth like $5 or $6 billion. But I have a horrible suspicion it's going to be a private business when that happens.
Right. I mean, how's it going to grow, though, to get to, say, 10,000 or 11,000 units? I know you say it should be easy, but if they've only been doing 6.5 in a, and it's not a easy market to sell sort of high-value items, discretionary items, even to the super luxury, you know, market, etc. How are they going to get? How are they almost going to double their turnover and their, you know, their units?
Well, a lot of it was they couldn't make enough.
Right.
They haven't really had a huge issue with demand. And 6,500 sounds like a lot, and it's not a brilliant market for luxury goods. But as I say, you know, Ferrari can sell every car it makes, and I haven't got the numbers to hand, but yeah. they probably make 10 times as many cars as Aston Martin. There's plenty of buyers out there. So instead of thinking about it as how do they get a 50, 60, 70% uplift in the number of units sold, think about it as how can they take 2% of Porsche, Ferrari, Lamborghini, and two or three others combined? Because that's what they're actually trying to do.
Yeah.
So know what I'm saying?
I do, yeah. As I say,
I don't own it because I just feel like the equity holders aren't going to benefit from it.
Yeah, they could get taken out anyway at a low. Okay, good. Well, let's go to another one. We've got, which has been sort of like going through the mill a bit, but it looks like it could be a potential turnaround, is Vistry, the house builder. Yeah. It's sort of like used to do sort of a UK national house builder, used to just build its own houses and sell them privately, but now did a sort of like a almost a 360 on its strategy and decided to move into affordable homes. The shares did really well. And then it's had a couple of profit warnings just before Christmas that have sent the share price crashing, and it's below its current net tangible book value. Why are you looking at this as being a sort of potential recovery share?
So remember what I said was the third best performing stock in the S&P over 500 years, over 30 years?
Oh, yeah, the house builder.
It was NVR. What Vistry's trying to do, and it's got an American influence, there's American money gone in there. They're trying to turn it into NVR effectively. So what NVR do that's different to say Persimmon is they do what's called partnership builds. Mm. So traditional house builder, you go out, you buy land, you get planning permission, you get all your plumbing and your electrics and everything in, you build the houses, you market the houses, you sell the houses, and the whole thing takes 8 years. What someone like NVR do is a local authority says, here is some land. We want a site of 452 houses on it. We've already done all of everything. All we need is someone to build them. And NVR come in and build them. And Vistry is trying to do the same sort of thing where, like, you know, where I live in Rugby, say they want to build a big council estate somewhere, and Rugby Council say, okay, we want 237 houses. We need someone to build it for it. That's what Vistry do. The problem with that is, as I've said this at the start, if when you're investing in businesses, you're investing in people. And just because you try and do a similar strategy to NVR doesn't make you NVR. It makes you Vistry.
Yeah.
What happened last year, I mean, it looked like they were getting somewhere. One of the attractions of moving to the NVR model is building houses like that means you don't have to sit on land or stocks for very long. So your balance sheet is a lot lighter, lower margin, but much higher returns on capital. So one thing it was like, Vistry's balance sheet therefore looks really, really strong. And they're like returning £1 billion over the next few years, which is big in the context of its market capitalization, especially now.
Yeah.
Sorry, I've somewhat lost my train of thought.
You were saying that they've moved this business model into affordable homes where they become a contractor of house building rather than actually taking the prime, and therefore you get a release of capital.
I've been taking an interest in it. What happened last year is, and it's the standard stock market saying, profit warnings come in threes. They had a profit warning in summer, or it was actually, I think it was autumn. I think they've had three quite quickly. Where one of their divisions, which was responsible for, I think, 9 sites, the divisional director or divisional manager had done a poor job of estimating costs or worse to that effect. And 9 out of 300 sites, you think, well, that's only 3% of the business. But it's like it's going to cost us £80 million. And suddenly that's a very big number. And then you had another profit warning. Well, it's not in any other sites. It was only in that one, but it's not £80 million. It's 150 million quid. And then a bit later on, some of our partnership things have been delayed a bit, and that 150 million is 170 million. It was just crap. I'm sorry. Rubbish, all the way along. Now you're at the point where, I don't own it, and I would have to be looking at technicals to decide whether I think the market is getting comfortable that it's all behind it. In theory, Vistry is in a good place because you're going to have a lot more houses, particularly social houses, theoretically built over the next 5 years. Its balance sheet is superb, really, once you include the vast amount of excess capital they've got. And it's, as you say, it's on a discount to NAV. And because these sorts of businesses should generate higher returns on capital, in theory, it should trade on a multiple of NAV. So you add those things together, and you can make a situation where if everything goes right, in a few years' time, it's 5 or 6 times higher than it currently is. Sounds a lot, but it's not out of the question. I am watching it, but I'd be reluctant when I do buy it. I won't go big, and I'm not going in anytime soon.
Mm. Just when you come back to the first point you made when we started on the management team, obviously the CEO, Greg Fitzgerald, is a rock star within the industry. He was at Galliford Try, then went into the precursor to Vistry, which then bought, obviously, Countryside Properties. And it's sort of been a bit of a blot on his reputation this last sort of 6 months, etc. What's the longevity of that, what's the confidence you have in the management team now, given that what they've just gone through?
Well, that's a big part of why I'm sort of reluctantly looking at it. It's an old Buffett aphorism for you. When a management team with reputation meets a business with a bad reputation, it's usually the business that maintains its reputation.
Yes.
And that sort of worries me a little bit. And that's why I'm playing a long wait and see on this.
Okay.
It's a well-known thing. You know, it takes a lifetime to build a reputation and 20 seconds to ruin it. Mm-hmm. And it could take a while before his reputation comes back, and therefore any kind of valuation comes back into something like Vistry, unless it gets taken over, of course.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's move to another company in that particular sector, which is going through, it's been a trials and tribulations. On the building products, we've got Marshalls, which is known for its landscaping, pavings, but also is into sort of sustainable roofing products and stuff like this. It did really well in the lockdown as everybody renovated their houses and then struggled. It bought somebody at a quite high price, had a lot of debt, and the shares on the technical process seems to have bottomed out. Anyway, how are you seeing this one going forward?
Marshalls was an absolute stock market darling for a while. Really exceptionally well ran, but they need a tailwind. And the tailwind for them is always the UK construction sector, particularly house building, but UK construction in general. They like to say on their website that every single square of the Monopoly board, you will find Marshalls products. And the reality is pretty much everywhere you go, you will interact with a Marshalls product. Yeah. What they do is not overly exciting, but it's executed very, very well. The main reason why they did so badly post-lockdown is spiking mortgage rates has led to a difficult housing market. A difficult housing market means that suppliers to it, like Marshalls, start struggling.
Yeah.
And operational gearing can turn a 5, 10% decline in revenue into a 50% decline in profit, no problem. Mm. Why I think they're interesting is I still think they're really well ran, but they don't need a strong consumer sector. They just need a strong building sector, and you can foresee why you might get a strong building sector. And we've already mentioned it on Vistry, which is the current government is determined to build a lot more houses. Now, the current government, I think some people are looking at that and thinking, well, that means you're going to get Persimmon to build loads more housing estates and people are going to buy those houses, so you need to have them affordable. Whereas I actually think what the Labour government's doing is thinking, well, no, as long as they're houses, it doesn't matter whether they're nearly all social housing, as long as they get built, that's the main thing. And that's, it doesn't really matter what type of housing you get, Marshalls will benefit. And that operational gearing that sort of hurt them on the downside during COVID when the mortgage rates spiked could really help on the upside if we start seeing sustained increase in building activity. And to put it into context, they were making really, really high margins when the UK was making 220,000, 230,000 houses a year. The aim is to make 300,000 a year. And I think they'll probably fail at hitting 300,000 a year. But even if they hit 240, that's still higher than it used to be. And with operational gearing, that could mean quite a bit more margin and therefore even higher profitability. So the way you look at Marshalls is it's a good business in a tight spot where you can see the potential for tailwinds coming forward.
No, I would agree. I think the whole building sector actually next year could do really, really well. And if you select, sort of like your stock picking, then there could be some really, really good returns, because after 2 years of sort of like, decimation across the market, then there's some really attractive businesses that could could come back significantly on the operating leverage basis. Okay, good. Let's move switch sectors. We've got advertising. We've got much smaller. We've got Brave Bison, which basically does sort of digital advertising services for corporates, I think. And it's just purchased a new sort of like marketing business, Engage, that does sort of sports marketing. How do you see Brave Bison?
This is a classic situation where I've sort of watched management to pay attention to what they've been saying and what they've been doing.
Yeah.
Run by a couple of guys called Ollie and Theo Green.
Mm.
Really young. I think one's 30, one's 32. They took over it 5 years ago, so they were 25 and 25 at the time. I think they had the great good fortune of being born wealthy, so they could afford to do this. But that doesn't stop them being talented at what they do. They came in and they've said, you know, we understand the digital advertising space. One of them came from advertising. I think it was Ollie came from advertising and Theo came from finance, but it's probably the other way around now I've said that. but they've got this idea where they want to consolidate, buy and build in the digital advertising space. That's fair enough. You know, whatever, that's interesting enough. But then they're very, very good on communicating how they're kind of thinking about capital allocation and how they're trying to build. Interesting things about them is they don't overpay themselves. In fact, they probably underpay themselves. Most of their pay only starts really coming in once the share price gets above £3. So it's a very definite. We don't benefit till the shareholder benefits.
Above £3.
Sorry, £3.
Oh, £3. I was going to say, I was thinking, wow, they're not going to get paid much for a few years then.
No, sorry, I meant to say £3.
Okay.
It's a bit funny because, I mean, they look like one of these dodgy little penny shares you get at the bottom end of the AIM market. But, you know, you've got to remember that they took on an existing listed vehicle.
Yeah.
Because it's useful for raising finance, for helping your kind of acquisition process. I did wonder at one point, you know, why don't they do a consolidation and go for a 1-for-10 and become 21p a share rather than 2.1. But that's not a costless exercise. So I actually think it's probably a positive that they haven't done that because it shows that they're really interested in keeping costs low.
Yeah.
Now, where I've got interest in them is, I mean, last year they tried to buy the Mission Group.
Yes.
Interestingly, that's in the news today because the Mission Group has sold, I think, its largest division for a decent amount. Mission Group's up 20%. They were determined to pay a certain amount, 26, 27 million, somewhere around there. And they couldn't come to an agreement with Mission Group, so they walked away. I think that's a positive. Mm. If you can't get the business for the right price when you're doing consolidation of a sector, you should be prepared to walk away because ultimately, it's how you do well, regardless of what you're trying to consolidate. It's about how little you could pay for things, ultimately.
Yeah.
That's not always true, but usually true. As it happens, I think that sale by Mission Group this morning shows that the price they were paying was quite a low price. We're trying to pay was quite a low price, but that just means they're quite canny operators. So that was the first positivity. And then the second positivity is they made an acquisition in the last 2 months, not that long ago, as you say, this Engage. And for me, the interesting thing about that is how they're funding it. So they had I think on the balance sheet, it said they had about 6 million quid. But if you speak to them, I think they said they had more like 9 or 10 because it's like an interim balance sheet period. And they've paid 10 million quid-ish for this Engage. But it's only 2 million quid up front. Then they get another 2 million in equity, so that sort of, you know, aligns them with shareholders. Yeah. But then the other 6 million is based over the next 3 years, and it's all about performance. So if the business they buy does well enough, then the people they're buying from can earn more. So they're being quite canny with the walking away from an acquisition that got too expensive, and they've been quite canny with the way they paid for one. So, you know, I look at these two guys, and to me, it looks a little bit like, and we're going to talk about these later. It's completely different completely different, but there is a superficial similarity, which was, if you imagine Volver 20 years ago, a couple of young guys, idea, were very well aligned with shareholders, very honest and very open, doing very different things. But as I say, I've said it before, I say it again, it's about investing in people. And having watched Ollie and Theo over the last few years, I've become more and more comfortable that they are the real deal. Yeah. And then on top of it, they're as cheap as chips. I mean, they're like 5 times EBIT, something like that.
Yeah, no, they're 7.5 times per year. Yeah, and they've got cash on the balance sheet. No, I would agree. Yeah. Okay, good. Let's switch to that, the company you talked about, Volver, which is, I think, is really sort of like a company, a corporate doctor, really. It takes businesses in sectors they understand and then buys them cheap, turns them around, and then either sells them or just carry it, holds them onto it. I've not known anybody else to sort of talk about Volver. So I don't know if you want to take us through how you, what the sort of the investment thesis is on it.
Well, Volver, as you say, corporate doctor is a good way of putting it. They go away. It was set up by two brothers, Jonathan and Nicholas Lander. Very sadly, one of them died last year. I don't know the ins and outs of it, but I suspect he'd been ill and he succumbed to his illness. But they set it up when they were both in their early 30s. And it was just this idea that they were going to go in and buy and improve businesses in different sectors, but sectors where they felt they could get expertise. So they were typically buying things that were overgeared, underinvested, poorly managed, weren't addressing their market very well, that kind of thing. Buy the business, turn it into something better, exit the business, buy a new business, do it, repeat, rinse and repeat. And they've done exceptionally well at it. As I say, they've always been well aligned with shareholders. So I think their compound average growth rate since founding, including dividends reinvested and all that kind of stuff, is, 15, 16, 17%. Doesn't look like it. They've done really, really well. Their current area they're involved in is food mainly.
Shire Foods, isn't it?
Shire Foods, which is just down the road from me in Leamington, and they made other acquisitions to sort of bolt into it and what have you. At some point in the future, they will exit it. I've owned Volver for years, and they've done me well, and that's because they've done well. I have no doubt that the remaining brother has the ability to continue doing this if he wanted to. However, as a shareholder who has benefited from it a long, long time, I wouldn't feel at all aggrieved if this was his last deal and at this point he decided to pull away and maybe just do a capital return to shareholders or something like that. It's a sad situation, but it's one of those businesses that the people who have held it for a long time have benefited enormously. And actually, from a personal point of view, you ever met either of the Lander brothers? They are very, very nice, very open people, very easy to very easy to understand. I've had it for a long time. I'm still sat on it. It's probably on a discount to its NAV because it always is.
Yeah.
They've taken steps to kind of address it in the last year, but I'm sure it's still on a bit of a discount. As I say, at some point in the future, every day that we go forward, we're one day closer to when they'll exit Shire, I suspect. And at that point, it's probably done. And that's the lifespan of Volver. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the remaining brother will continue doing it, but I wouldn't blame him if he decided he wanted to retire after this one.
Yeah. How much is Shire Foods worth more than the NAV? I know they've got a shed.
The NAV is masses of cash.
I know. Yeah, I get it. But
I think when you add the cash with Shire, it probably is. I'd have to actually look at some figures. But the thing is, it's all a bit theoretical anyway. Because the balance sheet of Shire on Volver is going to be what they paid for it plus what they've invested in it minus what they've amortized or depreciated from it.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily what they're going to sell it for.
Exactly. Yeah, which is why I asked. Okay, cool. All right, well, let's move to another one with the corporate doctor. Similar sort of very good track record. In fact, I think they've done 20% per annum since about 2012. He's Avingtraz, an engineering specialist in regulated markets, and that's its sort of core bread and butter. It's also just recently built out a med tech business
with
3D x-rays and MRIs, etc. How are you seeing this one going forward? The shares have come down a bit, actually, just of late.
They have. I think their aim, so it just seems to get capital outflows.
Yeah.
Again, I've said it before, I'll say it again, I'll probably say it again in the future. It's about management. These people really know how to operate. And as you say, they buy, improve, they sell. It's that kind of, I think, what do they call it?
A pie strategy. Pinpoint invest exit.
That's it. Pinpoint invest exit. And, they've done it really well over the time. They're currently, what, £3.76,
yeah.
The engineering business, which is if you speak to them, and actually if you just do some back of the fag packet calculations, you can easily get £5 for the engineering business. And then, as you say, they've got this med tech business. Now, it's much more difficult to value that one because it's a bit more early stage. It's a bit like, not likewise, but it's got that kind of growth aspect in it where it makes it more difficult to understand. But if you speak to them, they'll be like, well, there's another £5 in that. And then there's other bits and bobs, and you can get north of £10 quite easily. And then when you add to the fact that these are a management team that have executed a strategy that has returned getting up for 20% per annum over a long period of time, and then on top of that, they're probably a third of what they should be. It's hugely attractive.
I know there's some other good shareholders in there, isn't it? I know Harwood are in there big time.
I think that's right.
Okay, good. Let's move to another company we don't talk about at all, actually, is agricultural sort of commodities business that does a lot of growth. It's Camellia, which I think sort of like tea plantations and stuff like that. Yeah. What sort of attracted you to this one? Because obviously soft commodities are notoriously sort of suspect to hurricanes and cyclones and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah, these have always had management teams that like to emphasize the negative.
Okay.
I first came across Camellia, God, I don't know, 15 years ago. It was still main market then. It's main market these days. Camellia is a weird business. It's like some throwback to the Victorian era. And it was even more so 15 years ago. So if you look at it 15 years ago, you're looking at this thing and going, okay, your headquarters appears to be a stately home. You own art, stamp collection, 30 acres of parkland, a load of tea plantations, a private bank, a vineyard, lemon plantations, an engineering business. And it just never made any sense. And then on top of it, they'd never had a share split. So back then they were £110 a share. And other than Mount View Estates, they were the most expensive share in the UK. And they look at the shareholder register, and 51% has always been held by this obscure Bermuda-based trust called the Camellia Trust.
Right.
No one knows who owns the Camellia Trust, but I assume it's some old Victorian family.
Yeah.
So you're looking at it and going, well, this is weird. But then you do some sort of valuation stuff on it. And back then you could get £200-£250 a share out of it. And it was like £110. But you're looking at it and going, it doesn't matter. It's never going to get to its NAV because no one owns it. It's small, it's illiquid, and it's weird.
Yes.
But then the most unlikely thing in the world happened. Firstly, it was either MiFID II or RDR. I think it was RDR. And that forced them to sell their private bank, which is called Duncan Laurie, because it just wasn't economic anymore.
Yeah.
And then they had a period where, as you can see on there, especially since COVID, the share price has just gone down and down.
Yes.
And it's partly because of earnings, but I don't really know why it's gone down lows and lows and lows. Because if you look at it now, you can make a case that there is still £200 to £250 worth of assets in there, and it's now £47. But at the same time, you finally had a management team who I'm sure the big shareholder in the background, whoever it is gone, we need to sort this out. We can't have this thing being on this valuation anymore. So having had a headquarters, which, as I say, is genuinely a stately home, it looks like the White House. I think it's called Linden Park or something. They put that up for sale and moved into just a normal, out-of-town office space.
Yeah.
They put the parkland up for sale. They've sold all of their art and stamps and sculptures at auction. They're selling off this weird little Bermuda-based investment in an insurance company. And I think at present their market cap is going to be somewhere in the region of 100 million.
It's 130, but they've got 100 million of cash.
Yeah, well, that cash has come from the sale of the insurance business.
Yeah.
their headquarters was on Rightmove for 32.5 million quid. I mean, when I say stately home, I mean stately home. I don't think it sold for that. I'm not sure if it even has sold, but I do know it got reduced to about 28 at one point because it was in the news. They're actually trying to realize some of the value, which I never thought would happen because I thought it was just going to be some weird Victorian throwback forever. So because they're actually doing that, you know, there's no good being a value investor in something like Camellia unless there's a reason for that value to come around. Mm. And if they continue doing what they're doing, at some point people are going to have to look at it and go, you know, let's say they sell their headquarters, they sell the art, they sell a few other bits. I mean, they sold a Bangladeshi tea plantation recently, slightly less than NAV actually, but they did sell it. At some point, someone's going to look at it and go, hang on, there's 150 million quid of cash here and your market cap's 130.
Mm.
You know, it doesn't make sense. Yeah. Now, I'm not saying it's ever going to go up to your 200 to 250 quid. And it, you know, it, if they sell things below NAV, it isn't worth 200 to 250 anyway. It might be worth 150 to 100. 150 to 200. But all it has to do is close up to, say, 100 quid a share, which is where it was 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And you've more than doubled your money.
Yeah.
It's a very odd situation, though. It's a little bit like Ocean Wilson's in some respects, which was this.
Yes.
Which is doing a similar sort of thing, you know, trying to actually realize some of its balance sheet value.
Yeah. No, it's an unbundling, isn't it? A special situation, basically.
Mm. Effectively, yeah.
Yeah. Another one which has been undone a lot of unbundling is DCC, distributor basically of healthcare technology, which and sort of fuels, biofuels and this sort of stuff. I think it's probably across the world. Anyway, it's decided to sell off or to spin out two of its divisions, the healthcare and the technology, and concentrate on the sustainable side of its fuel. How are you seeing this one? Because again, we rarely actually ever cover this stock. It's $5 billion market cap.
I know. DCC absolutely amazes me. DCC listed in 1994. Development Capital Corporation, by the way. That's what DCC stands for. From 1994 to 2018, they generated 6,500%, at which time they were firmly in the FTSE 100. Yet virtually no one seemed to have heard of them. And it's still, I mean, they've been in the FTSE 100 for 10 years and no one seems to have heard of them. And I don't get why. Mm. Irish business, buy and build. So made about 300 acquisitions in 30 years. Mainly in fuel, so that's like 75% of the business, and they've always built bigger in fuel and energy in general. They're moving more towards like maintenance of renewable infrastructure and things like that. Just a fabulous track record of buy and build, and it's not it's not hard, it's not complicated what they do. They just don't overpay for things. In 2018 they decided they were going to move into the US LPG delivery business, because a lot of particularly the Midwest is not plugged into any grid because it's too sparsely populated. So, and there's loads of badly run, badly capitalized, over indebted small businesses doing that all over the Midwest. And they were like, well, we could just go over there and start buying them up, build them up, combine them into a larger business and fix it and make a load of money. So they raised some capital in 2018. 2019, they were trying to make some acquisitions in the US and they wanted to make one larger one. And there's quite a few lists, badly ran listed LPG delivery businesses in the US, but they couldn't get the valuation right. So they walked away. Just like the Brave Bison guys with Mission Group, they walked away, which is exactly what they should have done. 2020 happens and everything dries up. There's no, not no acquisitions, but virtually no acquisitions in 2020 because of COVID. 2021, virtually no acquisitions because of COVID. By the time you get to 2022, having made almost 300 acquisitions over 24 years, 94 to 2018, they've made virtually none for a few years, and those acquisitions is a big part of the driver of the growth. So growth continued, it was still positive, but just not nearly as positive it had been. And as a result, the valuation, and you can see it on this chart, it sort of peaked around the point of the capital raise, just below 80 quid, and we're now sort of around the 50 quid mark. Even though they are actually bigger and more profitable now than they were back then. So in 2022, they had a capital markets day where they basically said the energy business, which is our biggest business, without making any acquisitions, by 2030, we'll have doubled the EBIT. No one cared. Continue for two more years. 2024, so this year they had an update on capital markets day. You know how we said we're going to double profits over the next 8 years? Well, we're 2 years into that and it's going to be more than that because we underpromised. No one cared. So you know, you had this situation where this business, which hasn't been very well followed for some reason, has always been on a kind of 14 times EBIT.
Mm.
Is now on 8.
Yes.
And when you're a listed buy and build, your valuation matters because it, you know, effectively what a lot of what you're doing is buying private asset businesses and putting them into a public listed business. And you're getting a valuation discount close. And if you're only on 8 times, you're not getting that. So you're not getting the valuation uplift. And why Q4, as you mentioned, they announced that they've got a strategic review effectively on the technology and the healthcare business, which is the other 25% of the business. They've already, they're going to sell the one of them, which I can't remember which one it is. I think it's the tech business.
It's the healthcare they're selling it, oh, and they're strategic reviewing their technology.
But they'll sell them both.
Yeah.
And I suspect they'll sell them both for more than 8 times EBIT, probably like 12, 13 times.
Agreed.
So then you'll be looking at DCC and going, okay, you've sold 25% of your business for 50% more than we've got it valued for. And what's remaining is going to double in profitability in probably about the next 7 years. And that's without you making any acquisitions, which you'll probably do. So you look at DCC as a combined entity and you can go sell off those two businesses. That's a big cash inflow. They're all about returning that to shareholders. I hope they do it by a buyback if they carry on around the share price.
Mm.
Carry on running the energy business, get to 2030, 2031, 2032, carry on doing exactly what they've always done, which has generated 6,500% in 25 years.
Yeah.
And then if they're successful in that, what you're going to have by the early 2030s is a business generating in excess of $1 billion in EBIT. And if the valuation behaves itself, it should be on about 14 times. So 14 times $1 billion. From selling this stuff, actually, that wipes out any debt position. Okay, fine, they're going to give it back, but that should wipe out the debt position. So your $14 billion enterprise value should actually be not far off what your market cap is.
Yeah.
Pay a 4% dividend yield for the next 7 years on top of all of that, and suddenly your market cap of $5 billion looks absurd.
Mm. Yeah, you know, I guess it comes down to what multiple would you put on for a fuel distributor? Would you put 14 times? That's the nuts of it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and that could be what it is, but I mean, that's not all what they're doing. Remember, I mean, they are moving much more towards, you know, if you've got solar panels, you need to get maintenance. They own a business that does maintenance of that.
Yeah.
If you do biofuels, if you do wind farms, whatever it happens to be, they're moving to where the market's going as well.
Mm. Good. Okay, let's go to another one which is unbundling or has unbundled is Marlowe, which is basically now a sort of like an expert in or consultant expert in all things sort of inspection, testing, and certification of sort of safety and security. I think a bit of sort of like water purification and also in fire safety and stuff. And they sold a big business in governance about sometime last year, returned some capital, and then have also just spun out a healthcare business into AIM, I think, Optimal Health. So they've been through a bit of restructuring, to say the least.
Yeah.
How are you seeing this one now? Given it's really now just obviously concentrating on regulation.
Yeah, this is fascinating one. This one. So this was a Lord Ashcroft.
Yes.
Who incidentally is the largest shareholder of Bray Bison, just as an aside.
Oh, okay.
Financed buy and build in, as you say, testing, inspection, certification in the UK. So, you know, you own a warehouse, you have to get your air quality, you have to get your health and safety, you have to get your fire safety, you have to get your water purification. All that has to be tested every year. It's like having an MOT. And historically, it's always been like one person in a van comes and does one of those, another person in a van comes and does another one. And it's quite messy for the end user.
Yeah.
So Marlowe's idea, and it's pretty sensible, just buy lots of these little businesses, consolidate them together, become a one-stop shop.
Mm.
And if you don't overpay for things, which is the key, and they haven't been overpaying for things, then you get a very nice little business. You know, you end up, you know, this long-term buy and build, you know, like a different sector, but like a diploma type situation where it just builds year after year after year. Mm-hmm. Problem is somewhere along the way, Alex Dacre, who is the former CEO, has built up a technology business in there. And the technology business is, it sort of made sense because his idea is they're trying to turn themselves into a platform so that the customers, instead of just having, you know, their testing and inspection done, they also had this central repository, which was like, here's all your certifications held online. We hold it all and all this kind of stuff. And there was some, it made sense, but it moved away from their main purpose, which was just buy and build simple little businesses in testing and inspection. Sure. Now, I don't want to speculate what's happened, especially in a country with libel laws, but at some point along the way, this tech business has been spun out to Infineon, and Alex Dacre's gone with it. So right now, Lord Ashcroft, who is 77, 78 years old, is executive chairman while they find somebody that can do what they were hoping Alex Dacre was going to do, which was consolidate a testing inspection certification business.
Right.
Because of getting sidetracked in tech, the business looks quite cheap with a really, really interesting long-term possibility. Ashcroft's not an idiot. And I think it's something where you could be looking back in 10 years and instead of making 20 million EBIT, they're making 80 million EBIT. And instead of trading on 10 times EBIT, they're trading on 15 times EBIT.
Yeah.
And over that 10 years, you've made an awful lot of money, which is, let's face it, that's why Ashcroft's in it. He's trying to make an awful lot of money.
Yeah. Well, I think, he just enjoys the process. I don't think he's that bothered. He's rich anyway. He's not that bothered on the outcome. He likes the process of building businesses and the excitement. And just one question, I guess, given we've now got to move, particularly in the States, to deregulate, you know, sort of like laws and stuff, I'm guessing this isn't going to really impact it because it's in fire, it's in security.
It's UK only, for one thing.
Yeah.
When it was doing its tech stuff, it was going a bit international, but the main purpose of it all was UK testing inspection certification of commercial of commercial property.
Yeah.
And that's where they should be going. There's plenty of room to go at there without them worrying about, you know, differing laws in different countries and all that kind of stuff.
Okay, good. Okay, let's move to the last one, which is a real specialist in instrumentation, precision engineering, is Renishaw. That a lot of people have loved because it's done so well over the last sort of like, you know, 20-odd years. I've always personally struggled with the valuation, but I've been wrong. As you pointed out at the start in terms of, you know, if you have basically a winning formula, then they just keep turning the wheel on it and valuation shouldn't worry so much about value. Anyway, how do you see Renishaw?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's been a fabulous business, you know, a true global leader in the UK. And we don't have many true global leaders, you know, as well as it's done. Incidentally, I don't think share price terms, it's over the long term, it's not done as well as Hexagon, which is a kind of Swedish peer. So and the main thing is the metrology business, which is, you know, the science of measurement. So they make these little probes and stuff which get used in all sorts of different applications. The lottery ticket in there has always been the medical business, which is, it might not turn into anything, but if it does turn into something, it could turn into something very, very big indeed.
What's the medical? What do they do there?
They own a business that makes a robotic arm. And this robotic arm is for intracranial therapies.
Wow.
So in the US, probably the highest quality business in the entire world, it's a bit of a bold claim, but I might be right on this, is a company in the US called, and it's completely just gone out of my head.
Intuitive Surgical, Da Vinci?
Intuitive Surgical.
That's a good guess.
Da Vinci. 80% margins, absurdly good.
Yeah.
Intuitive makes surgical robots that does anything below the neck, because anything above the neck tends to be too precise, so it requires other things. So Renishaw, for years now, I've been developing this arm, which effectively is to do above the neck because it's much more precise. Now, that's fine, whatever. When they first started doing it, it was like, oh, maybe we could do ocular surgery or whatever it happens to be, you know, eye surgery and things. And that's fine, but it was only going to be a slow burn. But subsequently, what's happened is, a lot of the drug companies that are doing anything to do with brain research, you know, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, things like that, they're thinking more that actually what you need to be doing is direct intracranial therapies. So that's, you know, literally, you know, putting the therapies into the head, and that requires incredible precision.
Yes.
A lot of these, the way a lot of these are doing it is by using the Renishaw arm in their testing because it's so precise and they can actually do what they need to do. I don't know exactly where we are upon these things, but some of these big drug companies are in phase three or phase four on these certain products. But why it's a lottery ticket? If we get a situation where one of the big drug companies comes out and says, we've cured Alzheimer's, all you need to do is get this into the brain, suddenly every single place in the entire world that wants to be able to give this therapy needs a Renishaw arm. And then you've got a mini Intuitive Surgical sat in Renishaw.
Yeah.
So, you know, the business itself, ignoring the medical stuff, like the main metrology business, right now it looks a bit cheap. You know, it was double the share price a couple of years ago, which is fair enough. That's a nice investment case in and of itself. But then having this kind of medical business lottery ticket in there, and it's, you know, lottery tickets don't pay out very often, but it's plenty of people would invest in something like the Renishaw medical arm if it was listed on its own and losing money and just going, okay. But because it's actually, it happens to be in a profitable business as well, it means you're sort of getting it free in with the business. The other thing with Renishaw is they did try to sell themselves a couple of years ago, 2021. The founder, David McMurtry, and the co-founder, a guy called John Deere, both at this point were late 70s. Actually, I think John Deere was in his 80s already. but they had all sorts of stipulations on it, which was maintain a massive UK workforce. It's all about excellence in the UK. They were so rich, they didn't really care about the money. What they cared about was their legacy. And their legacy was this was a global leader based in the UK. And it meant that they could never get a sail away.
Yeah.
December 9th, David McMurtry died. 36% of the holding. He was just in his 80s. Bit of a hero of mine, actually. I've written an obituary about him in Money Week. That'll be in the next couple of weeks' time. I, from a personal point of view, I would like them to honour his stipulations and maintain this British-based excellence. But the market, well, Renishaw shares actually spiked the day that it was announced because you know what the market's like. Oh, yeah. It might get sold now because the guy telling everyone we're not going to sell it unless you keep on employing all the UK people has just popped his clogs, which is, it's just, sometimes it can be a bit grotesque. But so anyway, we're in a situation, failed Renishaw for a long time, ups and downs, particularly bought quite a lot when it got to around 13. It hasn't really moved from 30 either. Really, really good business. Again, it's more of a concept. Just look to the long term. They invest for the long term. You need to invest in the long term with them. Good business even without the medical thing. If the medical thing comes off, then it could be a really good business. And then in the background, you've got the fact that it's not impossible it might get sold. It would actually be a shame if it got sold, but it might get sold too.
Yeah, I would say certainly with that cranium robotic arm, that would be more appropriate potentially with what Elon Musk is doing with that. We're putting silicon chips in people's head, as an enhanced AI. I mean, he's trying to allow humans to compete against AI by enhancing their intelligence by putting sort of silicon chips inside their brains, and that'll have to be super precise as well. But you're right. I mean, if that comes off, it's a lottery ticket. If it comes off, it's absolutely amazing. Yeah. Okay. Good. Just so, with all those stocks, what's the sort of your top stock? What gives you the most excitement for 2025 for the rest of the year?
For 2025 as a single year, I'd say DCC. I think it's a big valuation discount, and management are actually motivated to try and fix that.
Yeah.
So you add those two things together, and you can actually make a case for it. Technicals don't look very good though, which bothers me slightly.
Yeah.
For the longer term wise.
Longer term wise, yeah, good. And they've got a final follow up from Ben Sharman. He's just asking about macro picture and comparing the overvaluation in the US to the UK. Is it go for the UK where there's intrinsic worth, or would you still be pitching some sort of like some money, allocating some money into the States?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't allocate at a country basis. I would always do it on a stock basis. If I could find a business where the management talks in a way that really excites me, and I think, you know, likewise, I mean, they do really interest me, then I would invest in that business. But it's not because it's listed in the UK, in the US. It's because it's the business. The problem is, you know, being a UK guy, you end up with a home bias because it's the area you know best.
Yeah. Yeah, and also you don't get hit by withholding taxes and all that kind of rubbish either.
Oh, yeah, exactly. It's a much simpler thing to do.
Yeah, great. All right, well, brilliant. Thanks very much, Jamie. Thanks, everyone, for your questions during the conversation. Been fascinating. And again, I'd just like to say a big shout-out to Edison for sponsoring the show and keeping the lights on. So thanks to those guys. And look forward in chatting in about sort of 6 months' time there, Jamie. So best of luck with all the investments.
Thanks very much, Paul. Have a good one.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com. You can't rely on blind faith to get the pregnancy support you deserve. Ritual's Essential Prenatal Multivitamin is the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Get 25% off when you visit ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.